The only thing we have to fear is fear itself. Fear itself. Fear itself.
From the Center for History and New Media at George Mason University, this is Digital Campus, featuring Tom Scheinfeld, Mills Kelly, Amanda French, and Dan Cohen.
Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country.
Fear itself.
This is Digital Campus, episode 93, a JSTOR and Jerry Springer Thanksgiving. Hello out there in internet land. Welcome to another episode of Digital Campus. We are on episode 93 in a Thanksgiving weekend. Actually, not the weekend yet. We are recording on Tuesday, November 20th, and we are getting ready to go eat our stomachs full with our family and friends. We are joined by our usual cast of regulars. Dan Cohen is here.
Hey, Amanda.
Dan, do you have a particular family dish that you guys eat at Thanksgiving?
Good question. We do not do the turducken. We usually actually just cook. We keep kosher, so it's occasionally hard to find a good bird that isn't over-brined and stuff like that. So we usually get just the turkey breast with like some ribs on it and cook it up that way, like on the grill. Really good. We should have a recipe edition of Digital Campus. Strange.
We do that biomolecular cooking stuff that they do. We're also joined by Tom Scheinfeld up there in CHNM New England. Tom, what are your family specialties at Thanksgiving?
It's a good question. I was tweeting this morning about donuts. The donuts up here in New England are something to behold. So I'll probably
be kosher donuts.
I don't know. I bet you can find them. So I will probably be stopping at one of our many local traditional cake donut shops on the way to Thanksgiving at my mother's. But in terms of the Thanksgiving meal, it's pretty traditional.
And we are also joined by Mills Kelly, who is just a hop, skip, and a jump away over in Global Affairs. Mills, any particular family food that you get to partake of at Thanksgiving?
Well, we have the fairly traditional Thanksgiving feast. I will, however, on Wednesday morning be cooking my tradition, which is Brussels sprouts, which are cooked in apple cider. Saute them in butter first with some onions and garlic, and then let them sort of cook in apple cider for a while. And let me tell you, they're good.
Folks can probably tell that we're recording today at noon.
That's right.
We're all ready for lunch.
Yeah, I got to head to lunch real soon here.
Yep. Well, I'm Amanda French. I'm also here at the Center for History and New Media. My family tradition lately, I discovered a little while ago how to make cranberry applesauce. So it's not just cranberry sauce, and it's not that cranberry sauce from a can, but it's basically just good New York apples and a bag of cranberries and some sugar and some water. Just boil it all down, and it's basically like applesauce, except it's that pretty cranberry color. And you put it that warm on turkey, and it's delicious.
Ooh. Oh, that sounds so good.
All right. Well, we must cease talking and thinking about food and go on to thinking about technology in colleges, libraries, archives, and museums. And we thought, given that it's Thanksgiving week, that we would do something of a local news edition of Digital Campus. With one exception, we did see a story of national and even global interest come out just recently, which is that JSTOR is offering a pilot program to the top 100 editors of Wikipedia. Reactions from the panel to this announcement?
Do you get why it's just 100? I mean, this is really neat, and I have to say, kudos to JSTOR for doing this. You know, the Wikimedia Foundation had surveyed their editors, and it was something like close to 40% thought that the biggest problem with writing and editing for Wikipedia was the fact that they didn't have access to the best scholarly sources. So, you know, the Wikimedia Foundation went to JSTOR and was able to get this free access to their 1,600 academic journals that, you know, we luckily have access to being on a campus. And you know, hopefully now they'll, these 100, you know, very high contributor, I mean, I assume they've done thousands and thousands of edits, but they'll start putting in links and better sources to JSTOR. I just don't get how then if you link from JSTOR, other people can't get through. I guess they can use that new free online access.
I think, Dan, you're being overly digital here, because what they'll do is put in unlinked citations, right?
They'll go to the link rather than to JSTOR to whatever, the History of Science journal. And,
no, they won't link to anything. They'll just put in a citation, Dan.
Mm.
Yeah.
Okay.
So just, you know, remember how that works? No link?
No, I don't. I have no room.
I noticed that too. The top 100 most active editors, which kind of doesn't sound like a lot, but apparently those people do a lot of the edits. My reaction to this story was colored a little bit by my recent experience of getting an email from the University of Virginia, my graduate alma mater, telling me that as an alumna, I would obtain access to some library databases, which I was very excited about because, you know, even now, even though I am still at a university at George Mason, I don't always have access to everything here that I did have access to at UVA. So I went through this whole kind of process to sign up for that, and I have to say I was a little disappointed by what they were offering. And actually, when I was telling somebody this story, the first thing that they immediately said was, JSTOR? Did they give you access to JSTOR? And I said, no, in fact, they did not give me access to JSTOR. I already have access to JSTOR through GMU. But the only things that I got access to as a UVA alumna were Academic Search Complete, which again, I already have access to through GMU, and which is a very sort of broad aggregator of mostly newspaper and magazine content. And then like a lot of specialized health databases, like nursing journals and stuff like that, which were not of use to me. So,
right.
I, you know, even tweeting about this JSTOR providing access to Wikipedia editors, a lot of people replied and said, oh, I can't wait. You know, I wish I had access to JSTOR. I can't get individual access to JSTOR. I think a lot of people would, I was almost wondering if it was an incentive program to you know, get people into the top 100 Wikipedia editors, but maybe that's.
I'm not a cynic, but if I were a cynic, I would also say that there's a benefit here to JSTOR. You know, anybody who's launched an outreach campaign for a web-based project knows that probably the very single best piece of publicity you can do is putting your URL into a Wikipedia article. You know, you go to the appropriate, you know, have somebody, probably not you, go to the appropriate Wikipedia articles and add your website as a reference as a resource to the Wikipedia articles. You know, and so this is a, you know, the more links from Wikipedia to JSTOR, you know, the better for JSTOR too. And, you know, and JSTOR is selling articles to individuals. So there's that as well. You know, there is, you know, if you don't have institutional access to JSTOR, there are other ways to pay for access to JSTOR, and probably not a lot of people are doing that. But if there are lots of links from Wikipedia, probably more people will do that. So I mean, I don't blame JSTOR at all for that, if that's part of the motivation. But I think it may be part of the motivation.
That is a good point. I was teasing Dan about, you know, the ability to not link. But you're probably right, Tom, that what these Wikipedia editors will do is put in a link to the article, and then people will hit the paywall when they get there. They'll see a little bit of an abstract and then be encouraged to pay a few bucks for that.
Yeah, yeah. And most people won't.
Right. But I mean, to be uncynical about it, they do have this new sort of modest access, this register and read beta that they have going on. And it does point to that from the Wikipedia article or Wikimedia Foundation article on this alliance with JSTOR, where, you know, there are these now, I think it's 75 journals that you can get free access to. You know, they're generally recent publications. And so, you know, I think Ithaca's trying to find ways to open up a little bit and to become more useful. You know, also in the last week, they launched this new JSTOR book site. And so I assume, you know, that'll be another really rich source for Wikipedians to use, that they can use these thousands of online books if they can get access. I'm not sure if they get access as part of that program or not.
Well, I'm one of the things I'm curious about is, you know, the question of the top 100, you know, why wasn't it the top 500 or something like that? And I recently was reading an article that really questions the degree to which there's a huge community of editors actively participating in edits of Wikipedia, that they, you know, they took a look at in this article, the article of the month. For 1 month, and so it's a very small sample, but just 30 days of article of the month, and found that the vast majority of edits were by only a couple of people on each article, and that most of the edits from the crowd of the crowdsourcing fame were you know, putting in a comma or something like that, nothing really significant, and so I'd be really interested to know just how many Wikipedia editors there are who might be classified as highly active. And because I suspect, based on reading this one article anyway, I suspect the number is a lot smaller than we probably think it is. And so the top 100 might be a substantial fraction of the population of editors who might be classified as very active.
Mm-hmm. Now, what was interesting, you know, the way that I edit Wikipedia, I have to say, is I definitely will correct you know, spelling and punctuation and grammar if I'm just idly perusing Wikipedia. You know, it doesn't take much to log in and edit. But I do have two or three articles that I have basically written that are my articles that I keep a watch on and sort of am very protective of. So I don't know whether that would classify me as a really active Wikipedia editor or not, but probably not. I know I'm not in the top 100, that's for sure. But I wonder if a lot of people have that same kind of pattern where they write their one article about the Jack Snipe of North America and then have a lot of edits on that one and then not very many on.
They're narrowly very active, but not broadly.
Well, it does say that this is a pilot. I mean, it's conceivable that if this goes well, they would expand this out to niche editors. But I think, and we can drop this into the show notes, you know, there was that article recently about at least the English language Wikipedia is, it's not coming to a close, but you know, all the kind of main articles have been written, and it's just like it's real edge articles that are still being developed. And so I assume what's kind of left is to really burnish what's still there. And that's where the really hardcore editors who will add links to academic content could be really valuable to just like fine tune it by really providing rigorous footnotes or links to content from JSTOR and elsewhere.
Yeah, and that's what most, when you visit Wikipedia these days, it seems almost like almost every article has, you know, says, hey, this article needs more references and more footnotes. Like, that's the main amount of work
we're trying
to get done. Well, you know, I went to Wikimania in the summer in July, and number one, there were way more than 100 people there, many of whom seemed to be very active editors. So there was that. But the other thing is that I went to a really interesting presentation, which I may have talked about a little bit, from the Public Library of Science, where they were talking about health articles on Wikipedia and the necessity of trying to update those health articles to cite not just single studies from medical research, but review studies from medical research. And, you know, they were working very closely with Wikipedia to try to make it easier for people to find and cite these review articles. So, you know, if there have been, 300 studies done on autism and its relationship to, the polio vaccine, then they, and 298 of them say, hey, the polio vaccine does not cause autism. And then two of them say, hey, maybe it does. You need to cite a review article that looks at the whole body of research and not just the sort of outlier studies. So I just thought it was really interesting that information providers do recognize that working with Wikipedia is a really important thing for the advancement of knowledge. So moving on from that story of broad interest to some stories of more local interest, which may also have broad interest to a wide number of people, but have particular interest for us. We have been busy, and some friends of ours have been busy, and so we thought we'd talk about some projects that are close to our heart. So yesterday we saw the launch of CUNY Commons in a Box. Tom, you want to tell us about this launch and what you think it means for higher education?
Sure. This is a great news, I think, for anyone in the academic community and elsewhere, actually, who are interested in building community sites. We saw, I guess it was just yesterday, that our friends Matt Gold and Boone Gurgis at the City University of New York launched Commons in a Box, which is an open source package built off of several technologies, primarily WordPress, and then building out from there BuddyPress, and then a bunch of other plugins and custom fittings. And it's designed to offer anyone who wants it the kind of functionality that has been on display and much admired at the CUNY Academic Commons for a couple of years now. So it provides a set of user profiles so if you want to set it up, for instance, on your campus, or MLA is setting it up for its membership. So any group of like-minded academics could install this and set it up, and it gives access to a profiling system, so you can set up individual user profiles, public profiles. It gives a kind of a listserv groups functionality, a kind of Google Groups kind of functionality. It provides members with a blog space. It provides something akin to a wiki pages, a place for general news, and all of the kind of functionality that you would see in a kind of online community. And in fact, in some ways, it reminds me of the system that people were using. It was a commercial system, and it went down, and I'm just trying to, what is the,
is it Ning?
Oh, Ning. A lot of people were using, yes, exactly. Thank you, Amanda. A lot of, public libraries, a lot of research groups and ad hoc teachers groups and other things were using this Ning service to do this kind of, it's sort of an individual or a custom social network for its users. And that service went down, and the groups went elsewhere, probably to Facebook and things. This does the same thing. So if you were a Ning user, this is something you probably want to take a look at. If you use Facebook for communicating with your membership or with your research group or whatever, this is probably something you want to take a look at. And it really is just a great achievement. It's an open source project. I think the group behind it is committed to maintaining it as a viable open source community. There's community documentation. They're doing all the right things that you need to do to make for a viable academic open source project. And so kudos to them, and congratulations. And it's going to be, I'm really excited to see where it goes.
Yeah. I'll jump out of turn a little bit here and say that my own personal little local news story is that we have redesigned thatcamp.org. with help from Boone Gurgis, who was one of the lead developers, or the lead developer on CUNY Commons in a Box. And basically what
Boone
we've
got... Boone had a bad day yesterday.
What's that? Boone
Boone had a bad day yesterday.
I think he had a very good day. Yeah. We launched both of these things. We launched CUNY Commons in a Box and the new thatcamp.org yesterday. Ours is a public beta launch. So we are still making tweaks. We're going to be doing that for roughly the next 3 weeks. We've sort of allotted that time for making a lot of changes and additions. But what's interesting, I guess I just wanted to mention it right now because basically, had CUNY Commons in a Box launched a year ago, we might just have adopted that rather than doing custom development on thatcamp.org. What we've done on thatcamp.org is very, very much the same kind of thing that they're doing with CUNY Commons in a Box. It's actually really nice to have all the custom programming, and we probably would have done that anyway. But what we found is that exact same need, that we have a community of people who are going to that camps, and that they need a way to communicate with each other that is specific to that topic and set of interests. So we too have implemented BuddyPress on thatcamp.org. We at ThatCamp had sort of the exact same problem that they had at CUNY, which led them to develop the CUNY Academic Commons to begin with. So CUNY, of course, is a major urban university system, and they had campuses all over, and were realizing that it was really difficult to create community among these geographically dispersed places that were sort of a theoretical community. So what they did was to set up the CUNY Academic Commons, and that allowed people to kind of see a lot of things that were going on across CUNY, which something like, even like Blackboard won't let you do that. Blackboard is so based on the notion of the course, the class. You know, it really locks you down to what's in your own course in general. And similarly, like at that camp, there have been so many that camps all around the world, and we set up a great network for those that camps, but it was always really difficult for people to see kind of what was going on at other that camps besides the one they were going to, because it was just like you have one that camp website. And you would have to sort of, you know, really go to all of them one at a time before you could see what was going on. So now that we've implemented BuddyPress, there's this great, if you go to thatcamp.org right now, listeners to Digital Campus, and click on the activity stream, That so far is my favorite part. That was just like not available before, where you can see what's going on at all the That Camp websites around the world. We've got That Camp Wellington in New Zealand coming up in just a couple of days from when we're recording this. So a number of the posts that are there on that activity stream are coming in there. And we're gonna be continuing to work on the sort of social features and profile features, but it's gonna let people kind of find other people who have been to a That Camp much more easily than they have been able to in the past, which is so crucial, because a lot of what we do is making connections between people.
Find that session proposal that you wrote 2 years ago for That Camp Kansas, in a central place.
Yeah, exactly. So I'm really excited about it, and it's very much on the same theoretical underpinning as CUNY Commons in a Box, that we do have, and it's really, I don't know if ideologically is the right word, but there is this sense that, Facebook is not enough, Twitter is not enough, that there really are communities that are formed around particular interests and organizations that need their own social network and need the kind of social networking ability that you get with things like that. So even academia.edu, it's just so broad, it's so vague. You need sort of more specific communities. So I'm really excited about thatcamp.org for that. That's my big piece of local news.
If I could just add one more piece to this, that I think it's great that, I think both That Camp and that the MLA are going to be modeling uses of, Commons in a Box / BuddyPress, based software, because I think you could look at the CUNY Academic Commons and think that this is only for a campus, that this is only the only groupings that could use this kind of software are you know, the individual campus or the individual university. But I think modeling it for the ThatCamp community, a kind of diffuse community, and the MLA, a kind of traditional scholarly community, shows that, you know, this can be used in a lot of different kinds of ways by different kinds of groupings that cut across universities and institutional boundaries. So I think it's going to be great to see how those instances or examples of commons in a box kind of functionality are built out, and then what other groups do from there with it. So exciting, very exciting.
Yep. No, I love it. Well, speaking of communities, I was away. I think I was at ThatCamp Digital Humanities and Libraries during the Mason Futures Conference, which was about the future of higher education. I was even a little bit too busy to watch the hashtag. So I was hoping we could hear a report on the Mason Futures Conference from Mills Kelly, who was there and who I believe spoke there. Mills, you want to tell us a little bit of news from George Mason University?
Sure, and I'm going to have Dan fill in on the final session because I was not there for the concluding session, where I understand that Dan caused all sorts of trouble. So I'd be interested to hear about what sort of trouble
it was. It was like an episode of Jerry Springer, Mills.
Awesome.
I was throwing chairs and.
I knew I shouldn't have skipped that last session, yeah. But at George Mason we have a new president, Angel Cabrera, and as new presidents do, he really wants us to think carefully about where we're going to be 10 years from now, and also we have a strategic planning process which needs to be planned and activated and all those things that big organizations like universities do, especially when they have a leadership transition. And so it seemed like, I think it seemed to him like a good opportunity to really think carefully about what not only the future of higher education was going to be, but really how George Mason was going to fit into what's happening out there in the wider marketplace for what we do. So we had a 2-day meeting, and he brought in lots of outside speakers, Jeff Salingo, the former editor of the Chronicle, and now editor at large, Anya Kamenetz, who wrote this book, DIYU, a variety of people like this to speak to big emerging trends in higher education, and also sort of blended those outsiders with people on campus, like myself, Kelly Shrum from the Center for History and New Media, Dan, Tyler Cowan, one of our prominent economists who has his own MOOC, MR University, or Mr. U. So it was an interesting 2 days. I mean, it was in some ways, it was largely to kind of get the university community on board with what's happening out there in the wider world and to realize that big changes are coming, and so we need to be ready for them in certain ways. But also it was a chance to speculate ourselves a little bit about what those changes might look like. And, you know, I think some of it's not news at all to our listeners, because, you know, they're tracked into what's happening in the digital world, which, whether you think MOOCs are going to be transformative or not, certainly there's a lot going on with digital delivery of educational content, and that has, I think, profound implications for where we're going to be as an industry in the next 10 years or so, especially given how much the leadership of higher education institutions seems to believe that online delivery is like the next big thing. And so everybody's got to get on board. And we've talked about that a lot on the podcast. But also, I think we learned some sort of useful data-driven things about just sort of the unsustainable level of student debt is out there, and what that might mean for our futures and our ability to raise our prices. And, you know, as we know, in pretty much every state in the union, legislators are divesting themselves, legislatures are divesting themselves of their state university systems. So, you know, our state support is getting less and less. So we're in a period of flux. And so I, you know, for people who want a lot more details, I live blogged the conference at edwired.org. You can just search under Future of Higher Education Conference. And so, you know, I thought it was interesting. I think I picked up a couple of small new good ideas. I don't think I learned anything that was big, but that's only because I've been paying attention to these sorts of things. I don't have a real sense for how new it was or how surprising it was to others who were there. Dan, what was your take on it?
Yeah, so, you know, I think I was a little bit more on the skeptical side than you, Mills. I think in part because my panel did come out at the end of the first day, which is a very long day. And some of the earlier panels had, like, you know, CEOs of education startups that are effectively trying to replace, you know, freshman and sophomore surveys. And in doing so, undercutting, you know, a huge part of the revenue. And I think that's sort of the crux of the issue, which is this really like inside baseball part of academia. But there's something called cross subsidies where those big freshman survey courses, which put a lot of seats, butts in the seat, and thus make a lot of money for the university, effectively subsidize the upper level courses and in effect also some of the research that goes on in the university. And I thought Steven Perlstein, who is now a faculty member here at Mason, but is probably best known for his economics columns at the Washington Post, he sort of, right before my panel, got up and made a really good point, which is, you know, as much as we wring our hands about things like student debt and rising tuition, although the rising tuition thing is somewhat problematic from a statistics standpoint, because actually there's greater subsidies going on. So the actual cost, there's a difference between the sticker price of the tuition and the actual cost that students pay, although obviously students are racking up debt. Steven Perlstein made this great point that, you know, what are we trying to maximize for? If we're trying to maximize for the least amount of cost for students, then, you know, yes, maybe we should go full MOOC and take out these freshman and sophomore courses and just have universities teach these upper level courses. But he makes a great point that, Perlstein made the great point that maybe as a society, we can live with these cross subsidies because A, we want advanced research going on in fields like science, and those big 100 person orgo courses pay for that. And B, you know, there's a lot to be gained by the upper level sort of hands-on one-on-one or, you know, seminar format. And if we lose the ability to teach that, we're losing a big part of education. So I think there was sort of a pitched battle about, you know, what should the future of education look like? And I just found the kind of venture capital funded education startups that were represented that were doing, you know, college for $99 a month, as like the same price as a gym membership. That was literally what one of the CEOs said. I think they were really confusing, and here I agree with Perlstein 100%. They're confusing cost with value, right? That somehow the cheapest form of information delivery, and that's what all these CEOs talked about, as, you know, what education meant is it was information delivery, when obviously education is much more than just information delivery. And so when we get into that sort of race to the bottom, cheapest form of education, cheapest form of information delivery, we're destroying a lot of other things. And I was trying to find some healthier point of equilibrium where we could imagine a future for education that would be able to still support the research mission and the advanced scholarship that goes on in the later years of college, and also the very important socialization and sort of social IQ pieces of higher ed, while still taking into account the fact that there's declining state funding and there's expanding costs, like mostly administration costs. About two-thirds of the costs of increase in the past couple of decades has to do with the expansion of administration at universities, not rising faculty salaries. So it's just a really complicated mess. I think what MOOCs have done is they've kind of focused everyone's fear on the issue, and I think it was healthy for our university to kind of open up a discussion about it. But I'm not sure anything was really solved at the meeting. It is worth, we can link to it from the show notes, but it is worth viewing some of the panels and some of the talks. It's at fhe.gmu.edu.
So Dan, yeah. And Mills, can I ask you something? Lately I've been thinking about MOOCs not in relationship to higher education and whether or not they are going to disrupt or destroy higher education, but MOOCs in relationship to the rest of the internet, basically, because...
Yeah, I think that's a good way of thinking of it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, you know, as you said, Dan, you know, most people sort of talk about MOOCs in terms of information delivery. And I have to say, I'm probably an atypical humanist in that I actually think that there's a lot of good to that notion of just information delivery, even in traditionally humanist subjects like, composition and English literature and history and so on. You know, sometimes I... get curmudgeonly and think, oh, you know, I just want my students to know, you know, how to use adjectives properly or whatever it is, you know. So, but nevertheless, I wonder about MOOCs is, what is the advantage of a MOOC over all of the information that is already out there on the internet?
Do you mean like the advantage to the student?
Yeah, the advantage to the student, you know, in terms of learning, because if MOOCs really are about mostly information delivery, mostly, obviously non-geographical learning. Why is it that you would need a MOOC instead of just buying your Intro to JavaScript book or mm-hmm. going to the yeah. one of 5 million sites that will teach you Intro to JavaScript? You know, what is there about a MOOC that is so much better than that?
Or if you want to know about Victorian literature or something,
oh, yeah, right.
or going to the Wikipedia article and then following the references and, right. and you know, spending it, you know, right. What does 100 hours spent in a MOOC
right.
give you that 100 hours spent on, you know,
self-educating?
So
not right. give you.
Yeah.
My answer is pretty simple, and that is that you're counting on the creator of the MOOC to have done the filtering for you. And so what you're getting is pre-filtered information as opposed to going to the internet and trying to decide, okay, of the 9,000 introduction to Java options, which one should I pick? Someone has made that choice for you, and so it's just efficient.
Yeah, but you could buy a book.
Yeah, but which book? Which book? Somebody else is in a MOOC. Somebody has picked a book for you. In that
well, but that's
this is actually
which MOOC, right? Yeah. And that raises
yeah,
the
right. Yeah, once there's more than one MOOC.
I think this is actually an Achilles heel of the MOOC hyperbole, one of the problems is, you know, if you look at every article, and actually Anya Kamenetz, who was on my panel, talked about this. She actually had a column for Fast Company in which she, used the internet to find some of the young people who were taking some of these Stanford MOOCs and. Of course, found that there were these like incredibly intelligent autodidacts taking them in Pakistan and Iran and other places. And, you know, my point on the panel was like, I'm not worried about those people, right? I mean, I think there's always been a way for autodidacts and smart people to go to the library, go, you know, now with the internet, surf around the internet, learn for themselves. You know, my concern is, what about the vast majority of people who actually need some kind of scaffolding to do high quality learning. And here's, I think, where Mills and I agree on this is, that's really where the rubber hits the road, right? And I think, if I'm being generous toward MOOCs, if they're able to evolve into a place where they can really provide that scaffolding for people who, you know, give up more easily, get confused about certain concept more easily, then that's great. But, you know, I think if you look at the standard YouTube video plus really kind of sketchy assessment, you know, 270-word essays in the case of some of these humanities courses or multiple choice, little multiple choice exams, I don't think they're really providing that scaffolding yet. And so, of course, there's going to be 5% of these people worldwide who can kind of do it on their own, and they would do it anyway, right, without even the MOOC existing. I'm interested in the 95%, and that's where, you know, large state universities like Mason come in.
Yep, absolutely.
Right, and it's where, you know, for me, it's where the rest of the internet comes in, too, because I am, and as I think we all are, you know, I am an open access advocate, and part of one of the main reasons why I'm an open access advocate is that I think that everybody should have the opportunity to teach themselves, you know, to learn. On a self-directed basis. And so, although I keep trying not to be as anti-MOOC as I sort of instinctively am, you know, I just don't get why, you know, you need a MOOC in order to kind of, almost in a way, you know, bring in the worst of the kind of star system of the university with the you know, maybe the worst of the internet, which is not having interpersonal interaction with people, including those stars in person. So I don't know, it's just, I wish I had been there at Mason Futures.
You can relive it from your couch by watching all those videos. There's like,
sadly,
18
hours. A self-directed autodidact, so I'm afraid I'm not going to be
just
able to do that.
Skip forward on my panel to the part where I start throwing chairs all around.
Okay, we'll do that.
And storm off.
All right, so we're nearly out of time. I think some of us are champing at the bit, to go and begin this Thanksgiving holiday. But I did just want to close out by asking Dan to talk a little bit more about the unsurprising fact that the Authors Guild has appealed the decision in the HathiTrust case. Dan, I understand that you appended your name to an amicus brief letter that is related to that appeal.
Yeah, it's actually the amicus brief was for the Google case, right? So there's two parallel cases. There's the Authors Guild versus Google. Remember that the American Association of Publishers, the AAP, settled with Google over the Google Books. This is all about, really, about Google Books. And HathiTrust won decisively in court last month. And the Authors Guild now has appealed that on what seems like pretty sketchy basis. I think HathiTrust is probably in pretty good shape on that. But amicus brief that I signed was written by Pamela Samuelson and David Hansen at Berkeley and the School of Law. And they filed this week a brief basically trying to get at this point, which I think is really critical, at least for us in academia, which is that the Authors Guild doesn't represent us, right? I mean, Amanda, you were just talking about open access. And one of the things that is sort of central to this brief, which is in support of Google in the case against brought against them by the Authors Guild, is that you know, academic authors like their ideas to be spread, and they also like to be able to use large book databases like Google Books. That it's really important for the promotion of the arts, and so. It's ridiculous to think that we're in the same boat as, you know, the Stephen Kings of the world and others that are represented by the Authors Guild. So I think it's very readable. We'll link to it from the show notes. But you can see how there's a real difference between the kind of ends of academic authors and those represented by the Authors Guild. And the brief basically says that the district court, Second Circuit Court of Appeals, should rule in favor of Google, just initially on this point of, you know, the Authors Guild not really being a class that represents all authors, and it also makes a lot of good points about Google's fair use defense, which I think a lot of us see as very persuasive to the notion that academia, you know, can really use this stuff to learn better and to promote knowledge. So it's only, you know, it's a, as these things go, relatively short. It's about a 50-page PDF, it's worth checking out if you're interested in what's going on with the Google Books cases. And actually, I think a lot of the arguments will probably come up again in the HathiTrust case as well, in terms of fair use and academic use, both as authors and as readers of books that are now in this great digital library.
Well, thanks for that bit of academic activism, Dan. I think everybody appreciates it. I've been very excited about this whole amicus brief genre recently, when the White House was calling for comment on adopting an open access policy. I wrote a letter, and that felt good. And I noticed that ADHO, the Association of Digital Humanities Organizations wrote a letter in support of that, of HathiTrust, that apparently did make a big difference in the positive decision in that case. So it's been it's a genre I'm looking forward to learning more about as the years go by. Well, thanks, Dan, Tom, and Mills for joining us for another episode of Digital Campus. And we'll see you all next time. And I hope everybody has a great Thanksgiving.
The only thing we have to fear is fear itself. Fear itself. Fear itself.
Please visit us online at digitalcampus.tv, where you can join in the discussion and let us know about stories and issues you would like us to cover on future episodes. Mike O'Malley wrote our theme music.
Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country.
Fear itself. Thank you.